One employer feeling encouraged and just starting to come back from the brink is Majestic Yachts Incorporated. They're a houseboat manufacturer in Columbia, Kentucky. I first came across Majestic 3 years ago. Jim Hadley, the president and CEO, had laid off dozens of employees. The machines had gone silent in his factory, and it was just down to Jim and his two co-owners.
We are kind of like an old rock band. We've been together a long time, and hopefully we'll be together a whole lot longer.
Back during that 2009 visit, I also spoke to one of Jim's employees, Faye Womack, who had just lost her job as a seamstress.
You know, you hate to lose your job. You know, it's bad. It is really bad. And there's nowhere here to get a job.
But with some signs of life in the economy, we decided to check in with Majestic Yachts. We gave CEO Jim Hadley another call and asked him how things are going now.
Well, currently, David, we're probably 20% of full capacity. Ourselves, we're hanging in there. As an industry, there were 13 manufacturers in our area 3 years ago. Today, there's only five left.
Wow.
We currently don't have any new orders. We did build one new order last year, but things are starting to turn around just a little bit more.
Well, if you're back to doing about 20% of the work that you were doing a few years ago, what does that mean in terms of employees? Have you been able to bring some of those few dozen people back on?
We have, David. We've been very, very fortunate in that we have brought five of our employees back. With the three of us that are already here, gives us a total of eight people.
Jim, one question I had, we hear this term thrown around by economists, discouraged workers, and those are people who have just given up on finding work. They're not even counted in the unemployment numbers. When you hear from the people who you had to lay off, are they still aggressively looking for jobs, or have some of them given up?
I think a lot of them are still looking, David, and a lot of them have returned to other jobs. And for those that haven't, are certainly discouraged in that can't find any jobs available. There are just not any there for them.
And Jim, you've been through other downturns before. Kind of step back and look at this one of the last few years and compare it to economic downturns of the past.
David, this downturn that we're currently in and hopefully coming out of has been just enormous compared to the things in the past. Back in the early 90s, there was a small downturn. It was only for a short period of time. This downturn is destroyed a lot of people.
Well, one of the things that really struck me about your company, Jim, was the family feeling that you had. I mean, you laid off several dozen people, but you were in touch with them, and they were in touch with you, you know, talking about how things were going, when they might be able to come back. Are you still in touch with a lot of the people who you laid off a couple years ago?
Well, that's a good thing about a small community, David. Columbia, Kentucky is a small community in the surrounding areas, but we're a very close-knit community. We've kind of got a new little thing going here that's brought us even closer as a group. Daily, Faye Womack, who is our seamstress, she also answers our phones. Now she is our head chef. She fixes an enormous breakfast every day for the employees.
Well, Faye, of course, I spent a lot of time with her in addition to you when I was there. So she's gone from being a seamstress. You don't have as much, you know, as many orders for big houseboats now. So you've been able to bring her back, but she's answering phones and doing cooking. So kind of adjusting to the new economy in a way.
Yes. And again, we do that as a small company. It gives us kind of one of the bonuses of being small, to where we can be very good to the folks that work with us.
Well, Jim, best of luck to you. Please tell your employee, Faye Womack, I send my best, and look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Thank you, David. We appreciate always talking with you.
That's Jim Hadley. He's the president and CEO of Majestic Yachts Incorporated in Columbia, Kentucky. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green, sitting in for Scott Simon. It turns out January was a surprisingly good month for the job market. U.S. employers added nearly 250,000 jobs last month, and the unemployment rate fell to 8.3%. That better-than-expected news from the Labor Department triggered a rally in the stock market yesterday, with the Dow climbing more than 150 points. The news could also help President Obama's numbers, as NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
All kinds of companies were hiring last month, 21,000 new construction jobs, 50,000 factory jobs, and 30,000 new jobs for temporary workers. Tom Mayer owns the Manpower Temporary Firm in Dayton, Ohio. He supplies a lot of workers to the auto industry.
Our business has been steadily improving. I've seen an increase in billable hours week over week, which is a wonderful indicator. So we're seeing, at least as the year begins, pretty positive activity.
Even as he writes those extra paychecks, though, Mayer is cautious. He was enjoying a similar boost in business this time last year, only to see it fizzle out after the Japanese tsunami wreaked havoc on U.S. supply chains, and the Arab Spring triggered a spike in oil prices.
It's very important to take things really one day at a time. While I'm optimistic, I'm not exuberantly optimistic. But things are improving. I read an article locally that our restaurants are much busier than they were before. They're hiring staff. So if people are spending more money on their dining entertainment, then obviously they're feeling more optimistic than they have been.
Nationwide, bars and restaurants added 33,000 workers last month. Overall, January's hiring spree was the strongest in 9 months, a pleasant surprise for forecasters like Nariman Baravesh of IHS Global Insight.
It's certainly too early to break out the champagne in the sense that this has been a very uneven recovery. But these are really good numbers, have been quite good for a couple of months, and so that at least we're getting going a little bit in terms of the hiring process.
And that could be a break for President Obama. The jobless rate is still high, higher than any president's been reelected with since Franklin Roosevelt. But political forecaster Charlie Cook says at least now Mr. Obama has a fighting chance in November.
The folks in the White House have had a lot of bad news for a really long time. You know, they're just starting to get a spat of some good news, and it points towards a real close race.
Of course, a lot could happen between now and Election Day. Cook says many voters will be making their judgments about the president's economic stewardship based on what happens over the next 6 to 8 months.
Public attitudes, they start off as a liquid, and then they turn into a gel, and then they harden at the end.
Mr. Obama acknowledged yesterday far too many Americans are still looking for work, and he warned the numbers could go up and down in the months to come. The jobless rate has tumbled nearly a full percentage point since August. It's now the lowest it's been since the president's first full month in office.
The unemployment rate came down because more people found work. And altogether, we've added 3.7 million new jobs over the last 23 months.
Mr. Obama urged lawmakers not to jeopardize the recovery by allowing a payroll tax cut to expire this month. After all the economy's been through, he says, it doesn't need any self-inflicted wounds.
So I want to send a clear message to Congress. Do not slow down the recovery that we're on. Don't muck it up. Keep it moving in the right direction.
Republicans argue the country could be enjoying a stronger recovery were it not for business uncertainty over taxes and regulation. But that in itself marks a shift in the debate. For years, it was the president, saddled with bad economic news, who was forced to argue things could be worse. Now, Mr. Obama can point to encouraging numbers, leaving the GOP with a challenge of making the case things could be better. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
To a movie director now, Ty West is 31 years old, and he has three movies coming out this year. West makes horror movies, slowly paced with minimal gore and a distinctive look borrowed from classic 1980s fright flicks. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, this could be the year that Ty West finds an audience beyond hardcore genre fans.
There's a kind of horror movie you don't have to be a horror fan to enjoy. The Shining, Rosemary's Baby, and maybe Ty West's breakthrough film from 3 years ago. The House of the Devil is about a seriously unlucky babysitter who gets a mysterious call.
I must be honest, I'm in dire need of someone.
You mean tonight?
our heroine finds herself at a shadowy mansion in the middle of nowhere with a sinister older couple. When they tell her she'll be watching an old lady, not a child, her best friend freaks out.
Do you remember the game plan? The game plan was, if they're weird, we leave. This is beyond weird. It's mental. You know, they lied to you. They lied to you.
I know.
They're liars.
Okay, I know you're right. But it's $400.
The House of the Devil is set in the 1980s, when the news was filled with real-life prosecutions of allegedly devil-worshipping preschool teachers. Ty West is just old enough to remember Satanic Panic.
I'm an only child, and I'm a bit of a weirdo, so I really kind of absorbed everything around me. So I do absolutely remember my mom telling me, you can't go down to the park by yourself because a van will come along and kidnap you and sacrifice to the devil. And she believed it.
The House of the Devil established Ty West as a masterful mimic of 1980s horror, from the rotary phones to the credits font. But West dislikes being pegged as the vintage horror guy.
It's one of those things that just everyone said is this sort of great homage to the 80s, and really I was just making an 80s period piece.
That might be a little disingenuous, says Adam Hart. He's an academic who studies horror.
There's a loving fetishization of the clothing and hairstyles. I don't think I've seen a Walkman play such a prominent role in any film ever.
The babysitter, having taken the job, is alone in the house. She dances on the furniture, pokes through jumbled drawers, peeks into dark closets, and explores room after ominous room.
You know, every time she walks in a room, you think, well, the movie's called House of the Devil, something's going to pop out at her and kill her, and it doesn't happen. And then she goes into another room, and it doesn't happen. And she goes into another room, and you're like, well, it's got to happen in this room, and then it doesn't. And then she goes into another, and you think, well, it has to happen in this room because it'd be insane to have her go into this room and not have something happen. And then when it doesn't, you kind of have to give up on being ahead of the movie.
That oppressive suspense reflects the tedium of low-wage work and how we pass the time, says film scholar Adam Hart.
It introduces the horrific and the supernatural into sort of everyday rhythms.
The director grew up in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. His mother works at a hospital gift shop. He sold jeans at Diesel while shooting his first feature film.
I've had every minimum wage job known to man. I don't want to go back to the minimum wage jobs, but I have there's a fondness for that. So I wanted to make a movie that encapsulated that feeling of being sort of stuck at work and the kind of apathy that comes with it.
What's up, Claire?
Hey.
In his new movie that just came out, The Innkeepers, Ty West toys with another favorite horror trope, the haunted hotel.
Do you know the story of Madeline O'Malley? She was the woman that died here in the hotel. She hung herself after her fiancé stood her up on their wedding day.
The innkeepers are not the inn's owners. They're a couple of workers. They clean, answer phones, and pull pranks on each other to stave off the boredom of taking care of the inn and its demanding guests.
Why do you think she sticks around here?
Beach me. Rates aren't that cheap. The courtyard by Marriott out on Route 13 is much better.
No, not her. I mean, Madeline. What do you think she wants?
I don't know. I don't spend my time trying to figure out what women want, especially dead ones.
Please.
The only thing that inspires Claire is searching through the hotel after hours for evidence of a ghost.
This is EVP recording of the laundry room.
It's a haunted hotel. You know how that works out in a horror movie. Larry Fessenden is a respected independent horror director who produced the film. He says Ty West's deliberate, slow pacing subverts not only the frenzied rhythms of contemporary horror films, but the rhythms of contemporary life.
There's obviously the slow food movement and the slow this and that movement, which is just to say everybody take a chill pill and get off your iPhones and just sort of take in life again. And I feel that in some odd way Ty's doing that in his filmmaking.
Fessenden appreciates what he calls West's observational approach to horror and the craftsmanship he brings to a genre that can feel cheap or over the top. By probing and prolonging the chills, he says, he's making them more meaningful. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. In October 1988, the big news was presidential politics. The race between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis was heading into its final weeks. But NBC's Tom Brokaw ended one nightly news broadcast with a story about stranded whales in Barrow, Alaska, turns out that was only the beginning. A dramatic whale rescue was about to captivate the world, thanks to news reports like this one from NPR's own Renee Montagne.
Now, three gray whales have been trapped in shallow water off Barrow, Alaska. Eskimo whale hunters, the National Guard, and environmentalists have banded together in an unlikely alliance.
That 1988 story is the focus of a movie in theaters right now, starring Drew Barrymore. It's called Big Miracle. The real miracle, though, is how this became a story at all. The fact that three whales could draw a media horde to frigid Alaska, not to mention grab the attention of people like President Ronald Reagan, might say a lot about the power of TV and how drama can turn a story that doesn't seem all that important into gripping news. Journalist and author Tom Rose wrote the book Big Miracle. He was among those journalists assigned in 1988 to bundle up and head up to a remote outpost in Alaska to cover a whale rescue. And he joins us from Indianapolis. Tom Rose, thanks for being here.
Thanks, David. Pleasure to be here.
Well, set the scene for us, if you can, back in 88. There are just so many elements that seem to come together to make this a story. These trapped whales weren't the kind that Native Alaskans, Eskimos, used to eat, so they weren't hunting them, which allowed them to survive, but kind of set the scene.
These three gray whales were stranded off the coast of Barrow, Alaska, off Point Barrow, which is the northernmost point of Alaska.
The top of the world, it seems.
Literally. I mean, literally and figuratively, about, 350 miles north of the Arctic Circle. Mm. Most of whales that are meant to survive end up getting on their way to their summer breeding grounds a lot earlier than the middle of October. These three, for some unknown reason, were stuck, ended up perhaps feeding too long. There was a baby among them. Perhaps the baby didn't have, you'll pardon the pun, his or her sea legs. They waited. Next thing you know, they're stuck in the ice. It was a natural and normal cause of death for those kinds of whales. Anyway, as it happens, there was a guy out on the ice who managed to capture this on television. The images were so compelling that, to continue with this awful Arctic metaphor, the snowball grew in size and scope that it...
You like the metaphors.
There you go.
Well, we don't have the actual images, but we do have some of the sort of compelling feel from the movie Big Miracle that's out now, that's based on your book. And I wanted to play one scene from it. This is a scene where a Native Alaskan fisherman is talking to an 11-year-old boy and telling him to put his ear up to the ice and listen to these whales.
Kneel down right there.
What?
Kneel down right there. Come on.
Okay.
Put your ear around the ice. Come on, listen. You hear them? The mother is speaking to the little one. Her calls are calm, gentle, soothing.
And Tom Rose, these are obviously actors, but you wrote that the real drama unfolding was not under the ice, but it was on top of it. It was the people.
Oh, absolutely. Everybody came to this story with their own preconceived notions about what was good or bad with the world. The environmentalist lobby had battled bitterly with commercial fishermen in the southern part of Alaska, in the rich commercial fishing grounds. They battled ferociously with whaling communities on the Arctic fringe of Alaska. Yet here, the subsistence whaling communities needed the environmentalists to help them make their case to the gathering media hordes that these were not bloodthirsty whale murderers, that they were subsistence hunters who knew more about whales, respected more of and about whales, had a greater love for whales than any of the environmentalists could have fathomed in 1,000 lifetimes.
And I suppose the environmentalists, this was a way to vindicate their view, that people care about animals and they really want to save them.
Absolutely correct. And had it not been for a woman who's portrayed in the movie as Drew Barrymore, the real-life character of Cindy Lowry, she was the Alaska field rep for Greenpeace back at the time of this in the late 1980s, none of this would have happened.
And so let's actually play another bit of the movie. So in this scene, John Krasinski plays a local reporter. He's with a whale rescue volunteer played by Drew Barrymore. They're in a car, and a network news reporter played by Kristen Bell is trying to hitch a ride with them.
Adam! Wait up! Adam? Hey.
Hey!
Do you have room for two more?
Yeah, we're good right there. Sure.
Thank you. Terry loaded in?
Whoa. Press have to find their own way out there.
Never heard that one before. Did you just make that up?
No, everybody is doing it.
Come on, lady. Help me out. Do it for the whales.
You don't care about the whales. You care about ratings.
Yeah, the ratings are what's going to keep the rescue going, which is going to save the whales.
She's right.
you were one of the reporters up there. You were sent there by a Japanese television company. I mean, were journalists fighting to get out there and capture these images for the right reasons? Did they feel like keeping the story going might save these whales? Was it all about ratings? And what were the journalists thinking?
It might have been all about ratings, but I guess, David, who cares if the end result is served? I mean, you couldn't help. Let me put it this way, and I'm an admittedly cynical guy, even back then. you couldn't help but be moved by these creatures. The initial hole that was secured for these whales was no more than 10, 11 feet long, 6 or 7 feet across. So when they came up and they had to take turns coming up to breathe, you literally could touch them. I mean, they were as close to you as the microphones are from you and me now. And it's hard not to identify with the majesty of a California gray whale when you're in that kind of constant proximity to them. So, again, intentions, who knows? I can't judge anybody's intentions. But at the end of the day, folks were brought together who otherwise never would have come together. You know, and that, in a way, was what this whole episode was all about.
Tom Rose is a radio talk show host on Sirius XM, and he is the author of Big Miracle. He joined us from Indianapolis. Tom, thanks for chatting.
Thank you, David.
Surprising as it may be, the Super Bowl is not the only sporting event taking place this weekend. It's also college basketball season, and there is a surprise team in this week's top 10. Sandwiched in between the usual suspects like Kansas and Michigan State is a team from Murray, Kentucky, a small town in the state's west. It's the Murray State Racers. They're 22-0, the only undefeated team left in men's college basketball. And we're joined now by the sports editor from the Murray Ledger and Times, Ricky Martin. Ricky, nice to have you here.
It's good to be here with you.
22-0. Was anyone in Murray expecting this from the Racers this season?
You know, winning has become the expectation in Murray for a long time, but winning at this level, certainly not anything that any of us expected.
And, you know, I lived in Murray back in the 80s. I remember them winning in the NCAA tournament against North Carolina State in 1988. And you guys had some success with an upset in the 2010 NCAA tournament, if I remember.
Yeah, it was a 13-seeded Murray State team that defeated Vanderbilt, who was the number four.
What sets this team apart, though? I mean, tell us about the team. Is there a star player we should know about?
Yeah, Isaiah Cannon is the name to know. He is the guy, the bona fide leader, and there might not be a better scorer in the country. But this team, you know, one of the things that really sets them apart is that everybody contributes. And outside of Isaiah, everybody knows their role and what they need to do. And so, I mean, it's a really special group.
I wonder about the expectation. Even if Murray State goes undefeated, you know, things will get tough in the tournament if they do go out early or something like that. I mean, are people going to be really disappointed?
If they lose in the NCAA tournament, it's always a disappointment, whether they're the favorite or not. Now, of course, this year, you know, there's more to be said about what the expectations are, the Sweet 16 berth and things like that, which has never happened in school history. But this is a talented team, a terrific coach, and they play in a good enough league that they can put up some pretty gaudy numbers.
Ricky Martin, just in a few words, can you give me a sense for like a scene or something you see around town that makes you just know that this season is really special?
I mean, the signs on the local businesses, that's the one thing, because this is a pretty small community, a very, very close community. Murray State University is what the city of Murray really thrives on. But, you know, the moment that really stands out to me, Ivan Aska, the senior forward, he broke his hand on December 30th, had to miss six games. He returned in a home game. In about the 14-minute mark of the second half, Ivan stood up to check in, and the entire place just erupted. 8,600 people screaming at the top of their lungs. It was so loud, he had to stop, take a minute, collect himself, wave to the crowd, and then they could continue playing basketball. But
Wow. That's
the kind of passion that these people in Murray have for this basketball team and the appreciation.
Well, Murray State will keep their fight going to hold on to that undefeated season with a contest tonight against Tennessee Martin. And Ricky Martin joined us from the newsroom at the Murray Ledger and Times in Murray, Kentucky. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Glad to do it. Thank you.
This is NPR News.